Good morning. This is Uncle Don again with Uncle Don Reads the Comics on CFUR, Canada's favorite university radio at 88.7 on the FM dial. I wish I spoke Yiddish. This language has a wealth of words for which there are no equivalents in English. One of my favorites is chutzpah. This means roughly unmitigated gall. The classic example of chutzpah is a boy convicted of murdering his parents having the chutzpah to ask for mercy on the grounds that he is an orphan. We have another example of chutzpah in the papers these days. George Bush, after failing to prevent the establishment of an international criminal court, is demanding that American citizens be immune from prosecution by this new court. Certainly the United States has reason to fear for the safety of all the war criminals it harbors, but it does not have to be so blatant about it. Henry Kissinger, the mass murderer and war criminal who helped engineer the slaughter of some 3.5 million Vietnamese seeking to avoid American rule, is still a big shot in Washington. Lieutenant William Calley, the man responsible for the massacre at My Lai in Vietnam, was last reported to be driving a Mercedes around Atlanta, Georgia, where he is considered a hero by the local veterans of that disgusting war. Yes, the Yankees harbor a lot of war criminals, and they intend to create more as they pursue their phony war on terror. I know who the terrorists are. George Bush is claiming the right to take preemptive action against countries that it considers to be threats to its hegemony. Remember his with us or against us statement in September last? Well, anyone who did not line up fast enough to kiss his butt was lumped into a ridiculous axis of evil category. I wonder what it would take to put Canada on that list. No fear with Chrétien at the helm. After all, he hosted Kananaskis, and the final part of that ass kiss is a lot to do with Chrétien. According to the Guardian Weekly of 13 June, Georgie has declared, quote, "The U.S. has the right to strike preemptively at any nation which it decides is developing weapons of mass destruction or supporting terrorism. It is carte blanche for a war on the world," unquote. Heavy stuff. All a country has to do is try to develop weapons for self-defense, and they can be blown to hell by a self-righteous United States. And what in hell gives the United States of bloody America the right to hold huge stockpiles of nuclear, biological, and chemical weapons? Well, they are burdened with the job of being the policemen of the world. That is what gives them the right. Never ask an American who appointed them to be the world's policemen. They get testy. Please remember, if you are offended by anything that Uncle Don says on the radio, please write irate letters to CFUR-FM, 3333 University Way, Prince George, V2N4Z9. I am counting on you. Any letters received may be edited and could be ridiculed on the air. Be warned. I have one letter here from Mrs. A.W. on Ewart Street. I can't read this on the air, but I'd like to comment to her. Same to you and the horse you rode in on, lady. Now here is an item from Misery Loves Company, Department of Uncle Don's News Service. In case you think that British Columbia and Canada are the only jurisdictions suffering from the depredations of predatory capitalist regimes, rest assured that the destroyers are at the helm in Australia also. The government of Australia has just announced that they are closing the government-owned employment agency and leaving all employment services to the mercies of the private sector. This should sound familiar to anyone old enough to remember Canada employment centers. When I was younger, I emigrated from the United States 3 times. Migration has been sort of a hobby with me. My second migration was to Australia, where I stayed for the better part of 2 years before deciding that my fondness for the local beer was leading me down a road that I did not foresee as anything but a dead end. You may know that beer down there is not just a pastime, it was something of a national religion. But that's not the point of this. When I was there, I enjoyed the post-war welfare state that has been largely dismantled since then. Under that system, there was a kind of merged welfare and unemployment system. An unemployed person could go to any employment office and register. He or she would be referred to any job openings that were registered. If the person had not worked for the past week, they were entitled to a benefit of $17. No questions asked. Now, $17 was not a royal benefit, but one could survive on it. In fact, there was a whole underclass of the unemployable, the infirm, and the plain lazy who lived on this benefit and did not try to find work. At that time, Australian society had the attitude of, who cares? How much of a drain would it be on society if a few thousand people lived on this meager benefit? It was enough for a judicious person to live on from week to week. In the cities, there was an underclass of people who lived in cheap furnished rooms and tended to be found in public parks on fair days, playing chess and just hanging out. They were not obnoxious, and no one seemed to mind their presence, nor the fact that they were not starving. Since Australia has signed on to the globalization agenda, it has become a mean and greedy land, not unlike Canada. Those who cannot or will not find work are relegated to begging or dumpster diving, just like here. Australia can be proud. During my time in Australia, I hitchhiked around Highway 1 from Sydney to Perth and back. I had a friend with the tag Sheriff Fang the Unwashed, with whom I traveled most of that time. On the way west, I stopped and found casual work in a gold mine in Kalgoorlie, Western Australia, while the sheriff went on to Perth to scout the work situation there. In Kalgoorlie, I took up residence at the Royal Chambers, a building made of corrugated iron, which was the cheapest place in town. I rented a bed in a shared room for $6 a week. Roommates came and went. One man with whom I shared this room was a man of about 50 who came with a large backpack which seemed to contain everything he owned. He soon demonstrated that he had been to every place in Australia that I had seen and most of the others. He knew where to stay and what to do in each. I asked him how long he'd been on the road. He replied, "Since the war." My God, he'd been living out of a backpack for 25 years. He had a disability pension as he suffered a nervous breakdown in the war, which rendered him unfit to stay in one place. I shared this room with him for a few days before he packed up and moved on. He was one person who could honestly say, "I've been everywhere, man," at least in as related to Australia. I had the pleasure of being in Kalgoorlie over Christmas time, the hottest part of the year. Every day I was there, it hit 100 degrees Fahrenheit before noon. Working in that crazy mine provided relief from the heat, as the temperature underground was constant and just warm instead of hot. Also, the ubiquitous Australian blowflies would not go underground. I supplemented my meager income from the mine by borrowing a few things. I assembled a collection of blasting caps and sticks of dynamite under my bunk. Great stuff to have laying around in case you need it. The need came on New Year's Eve in 1971. I was doing some serious drinking with a bunch of young guys who were looking for some excitement to celebrate. I suggested that we go into the desert and set off some fireworks. I fetched my explosive collection and we headed into the nearby outback. Now, the outback of the Nullarbor Plains surrounding Kalgoorlie is a barren stretch of desert riddled with abandoned mine shafts and derelict cars. We found that a stick of dynamite dropped down a mine shaft made a satisfying noise. We also discovered that autos could be disassembled in imaginative ways depending on where the dynamite sticks were inserted. We would plant a stick and then retreat behind a mound of dirt and wait for the explosion to rain shards of metal around us. We also developed a variation on the ever-popular game of chicken, whereby we would stand in a circle around a mine shaft and pass a stick of dynamite with a lighted fuse until someone decided the fuse was short enough for his satisfaction and threw the stick down the hole. My wife has pledged me to silence on this and similar incidents in front of my grandson on pain of death. I think that this is one of the adventures that helped me convince me to leave Australia and give up Foster's Lager before it could kill me. This is CFUR, Canada's favorite university radio, 88.7 on your FM dial, in spite of everything. Good news last week. Chrétien's $500 million party in Kananaskis yielded an agreement that we are all going to kick into a $20 billion pot to help Russia clean up its collection of Cold War weapons of mass destruction. The totalitarian system in the Soviet Union collapsed around 1990, and the world was left with a lot of dangerous toys in the remnants of that country and its satellites. But there is a cloud behind the good news. Who's going to clean up the fantastically deadly toys left behind when the American Empire collapses? While the old Soviet Union is no longer an offensive threat to the First World, the United States has been adding to its weapons of mass destruction. We know they're working on germ warfare from the revelations of the release of anthrax from their army stockpiles. They have announced their intentions to develop a new generation of tactical nuclear weapons, as well as putting nuclear weapons in space as part of their Star Wars scheme. They have increased their spending on, quote, defense, unquote, drastically in the years since 1990. Yes, there will be a lot of deadly trinkets out there to be disposed of. But the United States cannot collapse. Capitalism is strong. The U.S. has no peers economically. They rule the world and do as they please. Well, empires have come and gone through the ages. The Roman Empire lasted longer than the U.S. has, and it looked like it would last forever. Hitler had a Reich that would last 1,000 years. The Soviets believed that theirs was a system that would rule the world forever. The capitalist system as practiced by the United States has some weaknesses that could easily prove fatal. Predatory capitalism has to grow, or it will contract. There is no point of balance that can serve as a steady state. Many kinds of shocks can stop that growth. There can be a crisis of supply of vital resources, like, for instance, oil. There could be a revolt of the classes who are excluded from the economic party. There could be a series of strategic errors by the leaders that would bleed the country of its wealth. The other countries of the world could finally sicken of the arrogance and bullying of the United States and isolate that country to stew in its own juices. And there are the unknowns hiding in the shadows that could surprise us all, including the experts. When the end comes, we will not see it coming. The experts did not see the collapse of the Soviet Union coming. By the time the pattern becomes obvious, it will be too late to reverse. There are signs on the horizon of a growing crisis of American capitalism. As corporations merge, there is a growth of monopoly in many fields. It is most obvious to us in the convergence of the mass media leading to monsters like Canwest Global, controlled by the Asper clan, but it seems to be happening everywhere. More people are making obscene amounts of money while producing nothing of value. From multimillionaires playing children's games to corporate executives exploiting stock options, we have a huge class of parasites who possess obscene wealth and the power that goes with it. The political class, increasingly tied into that capitalist class, has conspired to eliminate the wealth, inheritance, and income taxes that were designed to keep this vast wealth from accumulating and being passed from one generation to another. There are looming shortages in critical resources, most notably oil and clean water, that will cause huge shocks to the economy when they hit the wall. World oil production is predicted to peak around 2020 or to 2040, and from then on, there will not be enough to go around. I have to admit that I own oil stocks in anticipation of an increase in price that will go with this shortage. So keep buying those SUVs, people. I need the money to maintain my standard of living. There's a growing underclass of those who have been left out of the economic system. These people present a threat to the system. Post-war governments had dealt with the underclass by providing welfare payments, unemployment insurance, subsidized housing, and food and such. Under the globalization scheme that crept in under the Reagan-Thatcher-Mulroney axis of evil, these people are gradually being cut out of the system that support supports that existed. Now they are being empowered by being thrown to the wolves of the free enterprise system. It has been determined by our rulers that it is better for their economy if the underclass is controlled by force. The growth of police, prisons, and military represents this repressive force. The United States now incarcerates about 2 million of its own citizens, largely for nonviolent economic and drug crimes, and many of these prisoners are held in privately owned prisons, which make big bucks from exploiting their captive labor. Many products are now produced in American prisons, paying pennies per hour to their convicts. These products compete with goods made by free labor, thus helping to undermine wages of free workers. This fits in neatly with the attack on organized labor, which has been so effective over the last quarter century. Will these people at the bottom be docile in the future? Stay tuned. The news lately is full of stories about dishonest accounting practices by and for some of the largest corporations around. Enron has gone down in a sea of red ink. WorldCom has revealed that it hid billions of dollars in debt to increase its stock value. Now Xerox has admitted that it inflated earnings figures by billions of dollars over the past 5 years. I have heard that in India it is common for a company to keep three sets of books, one set for the taxman that shows a loss, one for the stockholders that show a profit, and another set with the real numbers for the management. In North America, we seem to have dispensed with a third set of books. Downsizing, I suppose. Since the corporations are engaged in vast creative fiscal fraud, can we overlook the creative bookkeeping of our governments? Paul Martin has been a liar when he claims a surplus. He has stolen money from the health system, from unemployment insurance, and many programs that people need, and he claims that this constitutes sound fiscal management yielding a surplus. Well, I, for one, do not view stolen money as a positive thing. People have been paying into unemployment insurance who have no chance of ever collecting under the new rules. The difference between the money collected from working people and that paid out to people for whom the system was devised is treated as money earned by Paul Martin. Well, we don't have Paul Martin to kick around anymore, until later when this thief is liable to be our prime minister. Then there's our own dear Gordon Campbell. He promised tax cuts, a balanced budget, and increased spending. This is like an Escher drawing. It does not compute. Campbell is either terminally stupid or a liar. Me, I tend to subscribe to both beliefs. This is CFUR, Canada's favorite university radio at 88.7 FM. Have you been following the economic news? Boring, right? Wrong. There is an exciting drama unfolding out there. It is coming to the surface that corporate executives, the ones trusted to look after the assets of the stockholders, have been looting the corporations. First, we heard of the directors earning multi-million dollar salaries and bonuses. Then there are the stock options, a hidden way of milking stockholder value. Ah, but screw the stockholder, you say. Who cares? But we are all tied into that system in ways that make us have a piece of the action in the stock market. Our pensions, our jobs, if we were lucky enough to still work. The rate of interest we pay, the prices we pay, and the rate of inflation are all tied into the system. That's capitalism. The stock market is very volatile, as we all know. The markets go up and down, and we are treated to breathless reports of where the Dow and other indexes go from day to day and hour to hour. But our attention is not drawn to the construction of the so-called value of these indexes. What makes a stock have a certain value? A stock market is like a large flea market. What a stock is worth is what someone will pay for it. As an example, I will use the Canadian Imperial Bank of Commerce. This financial monster had an average of some 388 million shares outstanding in 2001. On the 26th of June, the Globe and Mail reported that each of these shares was worth $46.74. What was the basis of this valuation? On that day, 1,246,500 shares traded on the Toronto Stock Exchange, and that was the price at which the last sale was made. Now, that day's trading amounted to 0.32% of the stock outstanding, and the last sale was probably a small part of that minuscule percentage. That seems to be a pretty small sample from which to extrapolate a value to all of those 388 million shares being held by individuals and institutions. If a final sale of, say, 1,000 shares had been a dollar a share less, the papers would have announced that CIBC had lost a third of $1 billion in value. Think about it. Do the math. Ready for some more news? This is from the Globe and Mail of 11 June in the business section. This article was on the page reprinted daily from the Wall Street Journal. It's often interesting to see what worries the good folks on Wall Street who are looking after our economic welfare. It seems that there are some big retailers who want to sue the banks which own MasterCard and Visa. We're talking big guns here, including Walmart, Sears Roebuck, and their ilk, who are making the case that the credit card companies are using their dominance in the field to force them to take their debit cards. It seems that debit cards carry a larger fee for the banks than credit cards. The U.S. Supreme Court, the same court that inflicted another President Bush on the world, has given approval for a class action suit that could involve as many as 4 million merchants. The retailers claim they have been overcharged by the banks by some $13 billion plus, Yankee dollars, over the last decade. Now, I cannot believe that the retailers actually suffered such a loss. I suspect, because I am a cynical old bastard, that the charges were included in the prices paid by the public. I talked to a local merchant not long ago about his experience with debit cards. He told me that he has to have a dedicated phone line installed. He rents that cute little box on a wire which people punch their magic numbers. He pays a monthly flat fee to the bank, and then he pays 25 cents per transaction to that bank. He says that people will charge the smallest item on their debit cards, and he ends up with no profit at all on a $2 purchase or a single lottery ticket. He's the bugger who is caught in the middle because consumers are too lazy to go to a bank and take out the money we need for our quotidian transactions. My merchant friend told me that people who use these cards can also pay a transaction fee of up to $1.50 per transaction. It seems that debit cards are, like gambling, a voluntary tax on people who cannot do math. Do any of you read the Free Press? This is a pretty good local paper that is well worth the price. In the edition of 13 June, there was an irate letter from one of our dimmer citizens who complains that a downtown merchant refused to let her charge a purchase of $3.44. This store has a policy of not taking debit cards for less than a $5 sale. In the light of the preceding, who's the jerk here? If you were the merchant, would you be tempted to tell the lady where she could take her business? I've never had a debit card. I carry a wallet with sufficient money to take me through my day. When I need money, I visit the friendly folks who work at a branch of my credit union. They give me Canadian dollars, which are deducted from my account. It's old-fashioned, but it works and does not involve a predatory bank. This is not to say that I am not screwed by the banks or merchants. Those credit and debit cards, air miles, and customer loyalty programs of overweighty Canadian Tire, Shell, and Zellers all cost the stores money, and the costs are passed on to all of their customers through increased prices. Some years ago, there was a great frenzy amongst consumers when trading stamps began to be issued by stores. Stores would give out these little gummy stamps with purchases. Customers would glue these stamps into books, which could be traded in at redemption centers set up by the companies. Pretty soon there were several brands of stamps, green stamps, blue stamps, and others. Stores competed by giving double or triple stamps. And guess what? Prices were increased to cover the cost of these stamps. This fad faded after a few years, and people found that the effort and mess of the stamps was not worth the effort. The redemption stores disappeared, and the stamps are no more. Only the increased prices stayed the same. I doubt that debit cards will go the same way as trading stamps. Consumers are lazy and they like plastic. P.T. Barnum underestimated the rate of human reproduction when he said, "A sucker is born every minute." Do you find you have a problem with extra money? After you fall into the black hole of automobile ownership, you might find that you still have money in your pocket on payday. You can take care of that problem by buying a house. As soon as you begin to think about owning a house, the sharks will smell your blood and begin to circle. If you so much as slow your pace when you pass one of the windows with the pictures of the pretty houses, they know. The real estate agents, who have formed a club and call themselves realtors, thus making themselves professionals, are the first in line. They just want to help you find your dream home and take about 7% off the top. And the bankers want to help too. They will give you a special rate on a fine mortgage. Mortgage is a word derived from Middle English and means, roughly, a pledge to death. They will tie you up to their financial teat for the next 25 years. Once the banker signs you up for a loan at a rate barely 6 or 7% over what he is paying for the money he is lending you, you are ready for the lawyers. What might be a straightforward sale with any other item becomes totally arcane and requires specialized skills available only to those who have dragged themselves through law school. Your lawyer meets with a seller's lawyer over a few beers to decide how much they can milk you both for. Once your savings have been cleaned out to cover the fees and down payment, and you have been placed in hopeless debt for the better part of your life, you are ready to take possession of your dream home. Now you will be building equity in your new home rather than wasting your money on rent. But you're in for a surprise. When a roof leaks, it's your problem. I had a friend here in Prince George who finally decided to buy a little cottage in Pineview on 5 acres of swamp and scrub. One day in the spring, when he found his freezer floating in his flooded basement, he came out with the memorable statement, "A man in my position deserves a landlord to deal with these things." He had a valid point. I never thought of buying a house until I was over 50 and found the home my wife and I decided we wanted to live in for the rest of our lives. None of this starter home for me. When the real estate peddler refers to a starter home, he or she means that you will not be happy with this place and you will be back. Go for it. The real estate parasites, the bankers, and lawyers will be waiting. As for me, I will be busy fixing the roof. Another item in the Globe and Mail on the 11th of June is a full-page article entitled, "Is Henry Kissinger a War Criminal? Is the Pope Catholic?" Anyone aware of recent history knows that this is the worst fiend who has walked the earth since Hitler bought it in his bunker. Henry Kissinger bears the responsibility for the events of 11 September and all the innocents who died then. No, I don't mean the imaginative urban renewal project in New York on this last 11 September. I mean the overthrow of the elected government of Salvador Allende in Chile on 11 September 1973. The takeover of Chile by Pinochet and his crew of torturers and murderers was engineered by Henry Kissinger and his corporate allies. You see, Allende had made the grievous error of trying to run Chile for the benefit of the citizens of that country rather than for the corporations, largely American, that controlled its rich resources of farms, mines, and such. Allende had nationalized the copper mines, which had been owned by foreigners, and this angered Kissinger and his ilk in the United States. The overthrow of Allende and the installation of a nasty military dictatorship opened the way for Milton Friedman and his crew of economists from the, quote, Chicago school, unquote, to play economic games in Chile for several years. The result was the death, imprisonment, and torture of many citizens and the destruction of the economy for all but the rich. Kissinger was in the thick of it, and he is guilty of gross crimes. Perhaps someone could explain the rationale for the Nobel Prize Committee's awarding Henry Kissinger the Peace Prize after his involvement in the Christmas bombing of Hanoi and other war crimes in Vietnam. He is partially responsible for the deaths of some 3.5 million or more Vietnamese at the hands of the American military machine. From the Guardian Weekly of 13 June comes an article headlined, U.S. claims to have proof of Cuba's germ warfare effort. The article states that the, quote, head of intelligence for the U.S. State Department testified to a Senate committee that he had evidence that he would only provide in a closed-door session. But he insisted that it is convincing. Shades of McCarthyism. I have a list, but you cannot see it. The Cubans might well be investigating biological weapons since they have been used against the country by the United States more than once in the past 4 decades. After all, the American biological weapons research is supposed to be defensive. Why not the Cuban? When the anthrax that was recently mailed in the United States was found to have been developed from a strain developed by the U.S. Army, they could not narrow down the lead, as they said some 20 labs had worked with the stuff. Sounds dangerous to me. Which country is the one with all the weapons of mass destruction? Another recent bit in the Globe and Mail says that Cubans have been in the forefront of genetically engineering vaccines, one for hepatitis B and one for meningitis. It seems that the Americans are going to buy these vaccines from the Cubans, since no similar vaccines exist elsewhere. While Cubans have died from a lack of medicines that the Americans have illegally withheld, when the Americans want something, they get it. According to the Geneva Conventions, it is illegal to use the withholding of food or medicines as a tool of war. But then these are Americans, and they are, by definition, the good guys and can do no wrong. Well, that's it for today, kiddies. Goodbye from Uncle Don. I guess Tat will take care of the little bastards for another week.